Welcome to All the Things with Monique Dusson from the Center for Biblical Unity and Theology Mom, Krista Bontrager. And now, here's Krista and Monique.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of All the Things. I am Monique Dusson.
And I am Krista Bontrager, also known as Theology Mom.
And this is the show where we are talking about all things related to God, the Bible, and real life. You know, a couple months ago, we had our friend Katie Faust from the ministry or organization Them Before Us on our podcast. And on that podcast, she mentioned something very interesting. At least it was interesting to me. She said that people should consider, when in the workforce culture, having a theology of getting fired. And I was like, that is so interesting. What is a theology of getting fired? Because I actually do like working. I like receiving a paycheck. And so tonight we actually are going to tackle that subject, the theology of getting fired.
Yeah, that's good. And I think we have the right man for the job. Because after that exchange with Katie, I actually went on Google and just typed in the phrase theology of getting fired. And I was pretty surprised to see that our friend John Stone Street had actually done a podcast and a blog post about it back in like 2020 and 2021. And so we called him up and said, hey, can you come on our podcast and talk about this? And John Stone Street is the president, I want to get this correct, of the Colson Center. And they really do a lot to educate people about the Christian worldview. So we have John here, and we're going to talk about it and break it all down of his thoughts on a theology of getting fired.
And with that, let's welcome our friend John Stone Street.
Well, thanks. It's great to be on with you guys.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Maybe you could give us a quick kind of 2-minute introduction to who you are, John, and the work that you're doing there at the Colson Center.
2 minutes, man, that's going to be a little bit challenging. But I mean, basically, my story is I became fascinated with kind of the intellectual side of Christianity when I went to college. Kind of growing up, Christianity was a matter of the heart, not really a matter of the mind. And the world was a place to be condemned, not a place to be engaged. And so when I was introduced to the concept of Christianity as a worldview, as a whole way of seeing life and the world, thinking about not just kind of where I'm going to spend eternity, but creation, fall, redemption, restoration, the whole story that Scripture outlines, man, it was revolutionary for me. And, you know, as that kind of emerged, just the challenge, I think, that happens right now with just so many challenges in contemporary culture that many Christians just don't know how to think about. They don't know how to analyze. They don't really have a strong framework of faith to apply. And that's really what the Colson Center does. We do a daily commentary that's on podcast and email and on radio called Breakpoint. That was founded by the late Chuck Colson. That's the name of the Colson Center there. And Chuck really believed that the church needed to understand what was happening in the culture, make sense of it, so that they could actively be salt and light. And he was a student of church history and just really believed that Christians were at their best when they were running into the brokenness, not away from the brokenness. And that is repeated kind of throughout church history with some of the great leaders, but also some of the great grassroots movements where Christian revival took place. And then we also have a deep dive leadership program called the Colson Fellows program. And in about 60 cities and 70 churches, there are about 1,400 Christians that are just going deep in the idea of Christianity as a way of seeing all of life, seeing all of life under the lordship of Christ, engaging the issues that matter in culture and making a difference. Living out the kingdom of God wherever God's placed them. So those are some of the things that the Colson Center does, and what motivates me is a lot of my own story.
John, I'm glad that you brought up the idea of culture and the church and culture and our position in culture. You know, one of the things that really struck me about, and Krista, about the idea of the topic for this show is because we both have heard you talk about a theology of getting fired. Back in 2020, you said that woke culture isn't going away. And we can talk about what woke culture is, but the idea of this progressive or leftist leaning culture isn't going anywhere. And because it's not going anywhere, that we as Christians need to really develop and wrap our minds around a theology of getting fired. Can you help us think through what that phrase means? Like, what is exactly a theology of getting fired?
You know, I started after college working with college students and also with Summit Ministries. And one of the goals of Summit Ministries, I'm sure many of your viewers here know about Summit. They help prepare kids for the challenges they're going to face, especially in college when it comes to worldview and apologetic challenges and so on. And, you know, back in the day, it was kind of like, hey, are you willing to be made fun of, you know, for believing, you know, what you believe? And so we talk, for example, about questions of origins and creation evolution and, you know, say, look, you know, it's one thing to believe that God created the world in an environment where everyone believes that. It's another thing when you go to college and, you know, you're going to get made fun of. That's different than today, where if you believe, for example, that God created humans male and female, and that only men and women, one man, one woman should be married, and that sex is inherently connected to our you know, procreation and all of that. Like, if you believe that, you're not only considered to be wrong, you're considered to be evil. You know, you're not made fun of now, you're called a Nazi. That's a different level of pressure. And then and working with Chuck Colson and then also talking about the need to be really clear on what we believe and how different that is from the cultural pressure. You know, that was part of kind of my awakening on this, and then getting to know guys like Jack Phillips. Jack is runs Masterpiece Cake Shop in Denver, Colorado, just one of the most incredibly nice men you will ever meet. And then Baron L. Stutzman, who owned a florist shop, had a 10-year customer that was a friend of hers, basically end up complaining. And then the state of Washington went after her for over a decade. And after you meet these wonderful people, you realize, you know, that the whole line, well, if we're just nice as Christians, it'll be okay. Niceness doesn't, you know, doesn't keep that sort of cultural pressure out. And really what's, I think, kind of put the emphasis on it for me in terms of the pressure that I'm talking about with the theology of getting fired is a quote from Stanley Hauerwas, who's a theologian at Duke University. I probably wouldn't agree with him on everything given his perspective, but he said something a number of times that it just kind of haunts me. He said, if in 100 years, Christians are known as those who did not kill their young and did not kill their elderly, we will have done well. And when I first started quoting that, I thought, well, man, I hope we're known for more than that, but not less than that. And now I'm increasingly believing that the cultural pressure can get so great that we can rationalize and justify doing things that are just flat out wrong because of that cultural pressure. And if we're not going to go along with that level of cultural pressure, it's going to have to be intentional. We're going to have thought through the lines ahead of time. And that's all kind of into the theology of getting fired. And all I mean by that essentially is that we know where that line is, where we choose the hard obedience. You know, we choose to take the consequences because that is what faithfulness is. So a couple of years ago, I was speaking at a chapel at a wonderful Christian college. They do great work at this Christian college. They have a wonderful nursing program in particular. And I was talking to a group of nursing students there. And we were talking about some of the ethical challenges that were inherent in the work that they were going to. And I said, you know, here's what you're going to have to figure out. Like, you may spend, I think at the time, the tuition and room and board at this place was probably $45,000 or $50,000. And so you're like, you know, look, and so I said, you know, look, you may spend $200,000 on your education, and the most important decision you'll make to follow the Lord is to get fired. And that's where that phrase theology of getting fired kind of emerged in my mind, is that how do we think this through? It's going to be really hard to think it through in the moment of crisis. And this is what Jesus talked about in terms of counting the cost, know where you stand. And I don't think that means, and I think it's tempting, by the way, for Christians to fight every battle. You know, it was Friedrich Nietzsche who said, all truths are bloody truths to me. I know some Christians like that, right? Like, if I believe it, man, we are going to shed blood. Oh, I don't think that is a Christ-like thing. I don't think you have to, you know, fight every battle. I don't think you have to treat every issue as if it's an ultimate issue as opposed to a secondary and tertiary issue. But man, as the culture moves further away, not only from revealed truth, but from observable truth, then that decision becomes more and more likely. And I've experienced that, you know, with my own kid in, you know, just rec league basketball, you know, where a girl is claiming to be a boy, or a boy, more likely a boy is claiming to be a girl. And what does that mean for my daughters and public spaces and all those sorts of things? These are the sorts of questions that were unthinkable, you know, just a decade or so ago. And I think are really increasingly likely that most of us will have to face.
Well, let me ask you a little follow-up to your, Stanley Hauerwas? Is that how I'm saying?
Yeah, no, it's a tough name. Hauerwas, yeah. I think. Is
Hauerwas,
how you say
okay. Yeah. To that quote, I think it's a very provocative quote, and it's something I've thought about too, is 100 years from now, what will Christian faithfulness look like? You mentioned not killing the unborn and not killing our elderly. I'm wondering what else we might add to that list of faithfulness in light of our current cultural context.
Yeah, I think there's probably a number of things, and I think the source of them are all the same, that in our particular, I think, kind of theological anemia right now as the church, niceness is what masquerades as faithfulness. And in the name of niceness, you can justify killing grandpa. You know, in the name of niceness, you can, you know, justify entertaining someone's delusion that's actually harmful to them, and think that it's loving to tell someone something that is not true, or allow someone to believe what's not true. You know, this came to mind, Krista, this summer as well. I had the privilege of sitting and listening to a mom tell the story of her daughter. Heartbreaking story, typical COVID story. Daughter, junior high, bullied, and then COVID happens. Everyone gets sent home, so she spends the next, you know, 12 months essentially on a screen and hearing all the voices that come through on TikTok. And she starts to feel like the fact that she doesn't fit in, and she is, you know, she sees herself as being, you know, ugly and overweight, that the easiest solution is she was born into the wrong body. She doesn't tell her mom, but when she goes back to school, she tells school officials, and they immediately start transing her without the parent actually knowing. And when the parent does find out, the mom does find out, good heavens, she is heroic. She stands up for this girl. It's one of the most, you know, beautiful stories that I have ever heard. And of course, when I was seeing it now, the daughter has been reconciled with her mom. I mean, they're on stage, she's apologizing for all the horrible things she said to her mom and all that. And the mom was just like, I said, it's worth it for me if she hates me, that I tell her the truth. I mean, it was just, I'm just telling you, it was one of the most incredible things that I saw. But as the story emerged, here's what I started to realize. This woman, this mom, was all alone. There was no one standing with her. And the church was nowhere to be found. And, you know, I just thought, what a level of courage on that. And, you know, what a lot of the people in her life were telling her is that she was being unloving to her daughter. A lot of people were telling her that, you know, are you sure? Because, you know, what if it leads to, and of course, this is the suicide thing. So I think that's absolutely an example of another issue, that taking that hard stand right now, you're going to find yourself all alone. you're going to have to, you know, my friend Michael Miller, who is a scholar at the Acton Institute, calls it cocktail party pressure. I know we're all Christians, so we don't go to cocktail parties. But if we did, you know, the threat of not being invited back, you know, the social pressure and all that it, you know, it is that theology of getting canceled, the theology of getting ostracized, the
unfriended.
Theology of standing alone.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Losing your friends, being unfriended. And
yeah, no, that's exactly right. Now, I will say, too, to answer your question, Krista, sorry, I just wanted to finish this thought because I do think that there's the opposite thing that's happening right now, too, which is that all truths are bloody truths to me that we then sanctify in the name of Jesus, where if somebody is wrong on one thing, we treat them like an outcast. And a lot of times that takes the form of political allegiances. And I don't think that's of Christ either. So we're going to face that sort of kind of being fired. I think we need to have a different theology. You know, the other side of this theology of getting fired is, when do you fire someone?
Yeah.
I mean, there's certainly ways in which trusted, you know, pastors, theological leaders can no longer be trusted. There are lines that are to be crossed, but I think we're probably pretty quick to do that ourselves. And that's going to take kind of the wisdom and discernment of Jesus to know when that's the case.
So I think in your examples there, what you would add to that list of faithfulness, Christian faithfulness, and what that looks like in the everyday is, Christians are known 100 years from now. We didn't kill our unborn. We got married in a male-female marriage. Mm-hmm. We stayed together as much as possible. We had children. We raised those children. And that we did our best to help affirm our children in the God-given identities that he created them with as male and female, and that what we've taken for granted, you know, is the quote-unquote traditional family, that's going to start looking more and more unusual and as kind of part of an alternative lifestyle. But 100 years from now, that could very well be, well, that's how I knew it was a Christian family.
You know, and you notice all these issues have to do with identity, because that's the great philosophical and worldview challenge of our day. I think that it'll take the form of both standing for the truth, but more often not going along with the lie. That's an Alexander Solzhenitsyn line. The last thing he wrote before he was exiled from Russia was this: live not by lies. Rod Dreher recently has written a book using that kind of phrase. And, you know, Solzhenitsyn said something really interesting there. He said, you know, I'm not saying you have to go and to every protest and you have to, you know, get arrested over everything. What I'm saying is just don't go along with the lie. And that's why that Hauerwas quote to me has become so compelling, because I think that lie becomes more and more and more and more, compelling. In the case, for example, of physician assisted suicide, which of course is going under the name of medical assistance in dying now. I mean, think about the deception of that language. Not a single word in that nomenclature is accurate. It's not medical. It's not assistance. And it's not in dying. It's to die. I mean, every single line in that is wrong. Did you know 6 states here in the U.S. are now contemplating legislation to allow that sort of practice? And they're not using doctor-assisted suicide anymore. They're using medical assistance in dying language. So we're copying our Canadian neighbors on this. And we've seen how quickly that has escalated and justified. I'd add to your list as well, artificial reproductive technologies. Mm. In other words, that treating children as a kind of a consumer product that we can order when we want to. I think that falls into this category, you know, as well. And they all have to do, I think, with questions of identity. You know, what does it mean to be human? And what are the stands that I've got to take? Because I believe that humans are made in the image and in the likeness of God. And that's really who they are. And if that's the case, then we can't go along with, you know, all these other things. I think that's probably an accurate, how you described it there is pretty accurate. You know, when you were talking about that though, Krista, it brought to mind this line, because, you know, we can also look back in history, and historians actually have. Interestingly enough, a bunch of secular historians now are looking back at the Christian behavior in the early church or at various chapters in Christian history, and they're identifying, you know, what was that thing or that series of things back then. For example, there's been a wonderful bit of history kind of redone about when Christianity became the dominant kind of force in the Western Western world, and brought in marriage, for example, to the Roman Empire. And, you know, the traditional historical take from secular historians was, you know, all those pagans were having all this fun and those Christian prudes came and ruined it all. And what they're actually now saying is that's actually not the way that it went, because that sort of sexual free-for-all was brutal, especially on women and children. And so the idea that sex had a context within marriage was life-giving, and it was seen as kind of fresh air for a culture suffering from sexual exhaustion. I think the Me Too movement, you know, all the different directions that took, but that's a sign that maybe our culture is hitting a level of sexual exhaustion. I think you know, we had a hearing, what, just a couple weeks ago. I'm not sure when our conversation here will air, but just, you know, in early February, the only bipartisan thing that I can remember in recent memory are Republican and Democratic senators going after social media execs saying you're harming little kids, you know? So I think we're seeing signs of this exhaustion. There was a fascinating conversation between Tom Holland and Douglas Murray. There we go. That's the name I was looking for. And, you know, Tom Holland's a British historian who's done this really interesting work to talk about early Christianity and the difference that it made. And he's kind of come to that same conclusion that this sort of life-giving, you know, difference that the Christians were living changed the course of history. And Murray asked him, well, what advice would you give today's Christians? And here's what he said. He said, stay weird. Stay weird. And I thought, that's such a great piece of advice, isn't it? That we're going to have to stay weird. And we don't know what God's going to do with that weirdness. That's the other thing. You know, we're in the moment. But, you know, the earliest Christians went out into the backyards where little girls had been thrown out to an abandon, and saved those little girls because they thought they were human too. And what now we know is that actually led to the dominance of Christianity across the Western world just because of reproductive numbers, right? In other words, when the Roman men wanted to find women, they had to go to church because the church had all the women. And, you know, I'm not saying, you know, this is not an endorsement of missionary dating as a good idea, but it kind of happened there in Christian history. And, you know, I don't think any of those Christians, like if we could go back in time and meet this, you know, these people that are scouring the wilderness for these little kids and said, do you realize you're part of something that's literally going to change the course of history? Do you understand what I'm guessing? They'd be like, I don't know anything about that. I'm just trying to help her. And we need to have confidence that in our theology of getting fired, that our faithfulness may not lead to immediate success, but our faithfulness, God does the math with that. T.S. Eliot said, for us, there's only the trying, the rest is God's business. And I think that's probably something we need to live by today.
Now we're going to take a quick time out to hear from our sponsor, Maven.
Maven's immersive experiences are life-changing for students. And no, that is not an overstatement. I have seen it happen time and time again. Students go on these worldview and apologetic mission trips for a week and they come back transformed. And that is why we are opening up the immersive experience to students across the United States in 2024 with our very first open enrollment trip. On July 14th through 20th, you can send your student to Salt Lake City, Utah, and they will be trained and equipped and led through a life-changing immersive experience. Go to maventruth.com and look for the immersive experience open enrollment trip information there.
I And once again, if you want to know more information about the immersion experience that's coming up with our friends at Maven, go check out their website, maventruth.com. And we do want to let you know that the Center for Biblical Unity is partnering with Maven in a very special way for this immersion experience. We are actually going to sponsor a full scholarship for one person to go on the immersion experience. And there's a separate application process for that. But you can check out all of that latest information if you are subscribed to our weekly digital newsletter. We will have a full write-up in there, or you can also check back in our social media history for more information and get the links about the immersion experience and the special Center for Biblical Unity scholarship. Now, let's get back into the conversation here with John.
When I heard you and Krista talking earlier about, you know, things like marriage and having children and having family, these are the things that Christians really are going to need to be grounded and rooted in order to be considered countercultural. You know, like if we're only, you know, not killing our elderly and not killing our kids, what else is there for us? I think a lot of this is grounded in scripture. You know, thou shalt not murder. You know, Mary, we see the foundation for the family in Genesis with one man and one woman getting married and then starting a family. And we see the idea of work and all of that. And so when I think about these things, I think about scripture. What would be the scriptural standard or scriptural support, I guess, for a theology of getting fired? Because I had this conversation with someone and they were like, I need a Bible verse if you don't want me to get a paycheck. And I'm like, well, it's a little bit more than that, but we do need to be considering our theology of getting fired, but from what scriptural point?
Sure. Yeah. No. And I think, you know, to your point, there's not a Bible verse, and that's not how we're supposed to read the Bible anyway. We're supposed to read the Bible as a whole, right? And whole genres and whole selections, and in light of the overarching narrative of history that it tells. I mean, that's really the, you know, I think it was N.T. Wright who said, if the Bible's inspired, it's not just inspired in what it says, it's inspired in how it says it to us. And, you know, it's not a, Proverbs is, don't get me wrong, a collection of moral McNuggets, but the rest of the Bible is told differently. And so we need to see it. And to that point, I mean, good heavens, there's, you know, we can think of half a dozen off the top of our heads, specific narratives about God's people who took difficult stands. They made the choice, right? Daniel, making the stand, the children saying, look, God might save us. God might not save us. But they got into the fire and there was a fourth man in the fire, you know, the Hebrews there. You've also got, obviously, Joseph, you know, saying, you know, I'm going to be faithful in this difficult situation. And, you know, that means for me running away. Now, you know, we oftentimes see that when he ran away from Potiphar's wife as an act of moral obedience. But you think, I mean, as a servant running away from your master's house and your master's, wife, at that point, you're going to face some other consequences as well, which, of course, he did. And he ended up in prison. So there's, dozens of stories like that of people just making the hard choice. They don't always turn out as good as it did, for example, for Elijah on Mount Carmel, where he gets to talk trash for 4 hours and see fire coming down from heaven. I mean, that's a good result. If we knew we were always going to get that one, in there. I always like that story because as a former basketball player, I feel like God has sanctified trash talking. I'm kidding. That's not actually true, but it's there. He talks a good bit of trash there to those prophets of Baal. You have all kinds of examples of faithfulness when the cultural pressure includes not just social pressure, but real consequences, and that does bring to mind the Jack Phillips and the Baron L. Stutzmans of the world. We know that our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world, I think particularly Nigeria, was just named as the most dangerous place to be a Christian. I think that's or one of the most dangerous. It depends on how you do the math, but it's, you know, they got three different groups there, a state force and then two Islamic radical groups. By the way, the state force is also Islamic, but that persecution and that choice that people are making there has immediate sorts of consequences that we may not, you know, have and experience here. So I think you've got examples in Christian history. I think you've got examples, you know, throughout with stories, but also you've got the clear teaching of Paul. You have the clear teaching of Peter. You know, Paul's like, if you know the good thing to do and you don't do it, it's sin. You know, in other words, sin's not just doing what you know is wrong. It's not doing what you know is right. That's pretty clear in application to the situations that we're talking about. The exhortation to live by the truth, and the truth will set us free. When you're talking about the kind of cultural pressure to deny the truth at fundamental levels, to go along with lies, I think that's the brilliance of a Solzhenitsyn and how he articulated that. But, you know, jump to Peter, 1 Peter. The first three, four verses of that epistle tell you that this is written to a group of people who are facing persecution. They're actually, Peter employs language there that was used of the nation of Israel after the Assyrian and Babylonian captivities, the dispersion. We know from history that these are Christians that are facing kind of an early stage of persecution, but it's about to get a whole lot worse. And Peter's exhortation to them is faithfulness. Peter's exhortation to them is, in fact, you could say, just like you say, Philippians is the book of joy, right? Because it's all about how to have joy, and it's written in prison by Paul. 1 Peter is about hope, because it's all about hope. It's all about what hope is for a believer, that Christians have hope, not that they feel hope, and that it's not hope that the persecution will stop. That's what's profound. It's that no matter where this goes, Christ is risen from the dead. And so the resurrection of Christ is the center of hope, according to Peter. And then, you know, he exhorts them to be faithful. He exhorts them that if all of this is true, Jesus Christ is risen from the dead, which of course is the center of the whole biblical story and the center of all of human history. And if it's true, then that you're facing this time, faithfulness is what you're after. And there's, you know, I would send them to 1 Peter. I think there's enough there. Now, you know, again, there's not a thou shalt get fired verse, you know, and here's the list of things, but the whole narrative of the Bible, pits God's people against the world and the flesh and the devil. And it's not just, I know we think about that as if it's personal temptation. Like I've got to, you know, say no myself to these personal temptations. Most of the Bible was written to groups of people, not individuals. Most of the Bible is written to groups of people facing enormous cultural pressures, not being accepted. And we are the outlier in human history, right? We are the outlier in Christian history. So we've got to think systemically about what that means, what faithfulness looks like as a people, not just as an individual dealing with temptation.
I think that's a really important point. And I would add to that list the Hebrew midwives in the first chapters of Exodus.
Oh, great story. Yes.
That, you know, they, as you said, that they had something of consequence that could happen to them for their participation in not killing the Hebrew boys as they were born. And so I think that's...
That's so huge. Sorry, I just want to point out that that wasn't a choice about who to worship. That wasn't even like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? It wasn't that the Egyptians were saying, you have to worship these gods. It was that we're going to kill these kids, right? It was the same sort of, in other words, that their obedience, and they're mentioned later on in scripture too, aren't they? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember where, but they're kind of pointed to.
Yeah, I think so. And I'm not sure where, but yeah, I think they are pointed to as heroes of faith, you know? And so, yeah, I would just add to that. But I think that the broad point that I think we need to bring Christians to as they're thinking through their own personal situations, whether they're a business owner, whether they're a school teacher or a psychologist, of what are those areas that could potentially impact their job. For example, I was recently talking to a friend of the ministry, and she's a local public school teacher here in the area, and she had to attend a training, and she sent me the slides of the training that she had to go through. And, you know, it's all this affirmation and inclusion and queering business. And at the end, she had to commit or sign a statement that she would use a child's pronouns and be an ally for them. And so I asked her very directly, I said, well, what's your plan if you actually have to do this? Because you just signed your name to the dotted line here of what you're going to be up to. And I said, are you going to do that? And she said, yeah, I guess I need to start thinking through what I'm going to do in that situation. I said, yeah. And I said, I honestly think the time to start thinking that through is probably now, not when it happens. Because if you wait until it happens, you don't necessarily have a plan in place for your exit strategy financially, or how you're going to, you know, take care of your family situation and make up for that income temporarily. So these are kind of issues that I think it's important for all Christians to think about. Hey, I work in the medical field. These issues could probably start impacting me this way. What are the plans I'm going to start making now in order to prepare that I might have to leave? I just wonder if you could weigh in on that a little bit.
I think you're exactly right. Was that story in California, by the way?
Yes, that was in California.
Yeah. You know, and I think the mistake that Christians that aren't on the coast make is that these are issues at the coast, and we just can't assume that anymore.
Right.
I mean, listen, just today, the story is becoming public of a Catholic family who in 2021, the Child Protective Services removed their teenager from their home because they refused to affirm the pronouns. Like, I mean, that was in Indiana, kids. There's a story out of Montana. I mean, the story I told earlier about the mom who stood for her kid, that was in Wisconsin. The fact that you don't think you might actually have to think ahead in California is that's just that you're just not paying attention. That this is, you know, something that could become inevitable. If you're a nurse, I always think too, and I had the opportunity to meet this past year, one of the people responsible for starting to really create noise around the Tavistock Clinic in the UK. That was one of the gender transitioning clinics that shut down because of malpractice. This person just was relentless, along with two or three others, not a Christian. I don't know if there were Christians in that mix, but the fact that, for example, in St. Louis, the Washington Clinic, where are the Christians that are whistleblowing on this? I guess so far we don't have that many examples, and that's troubling to me, because are they not there? Maybe they're not even in that realm. Maybe they've already kind of pre-selected out, which I think, you know, some have to do. You got to start, you know, thinking about it now. The other side of this too, Krista, because you mentioned, okay, you know, having a plan to how to care and for your family and, you know, pay bills and that sort of things. I think that there needs to be churches thinking through a theology of getting fired. In other words, how are churches going to stand and help those families of people who have made that hard decision and lose their livelihoods? This is certainly what happens in countries that face persecution. If you see footage, and by the way, it's annual. I hate to predict it, and I hope I'm absolutely wrong, but the last six Christmases and the last six Easters in Nigeria, there have been specific aimed attacks at Christians in church and horrific slaughter. And one of the things that emerged in the stories after that were what the churches did to stand with those people who were killed. For example, they were all back in church the next Sunday, every single year.
You're right.
They are supporting those families. they are collecting money and bringing in those children. When I heard about the story, when I heard from the Wisconsin mom who just was so heroic and that she was just kind of all alone. A few years ago, I heard a similar story out of California where a child was taken from a mom's home by Child and Protective Services, also on over the gender issue. They did it at the time under the guise of mental health problems and suicide ideation. And this girl, her daughter was in a home for, or in a facility for, you know, for months. And the state actually refused for the mom to bring up Christianity or the gender issue with her daughter. Like there was a gag order in a sense. And the mom reached out to the pastor wasn't there. The daughter actually had connected with her youth pastor and asked about the youth pastor visiting. The youth pastor never visited. You know, so part of this theology of getting fired is not only when am I going to take the stand that I need to take, but it's also what are the rest of us going to do when it's my brother or sister who takes the stand that they need to take? And how do I stand with them? And I think that's going to be an incredibly important part of this and part of the church's witness to the world in the long run.
And that's so good. You know, where does the church step in? Where can we start to have some of these discussions? I'm so thankful that you hit on, you know, the church in Nigeria and how they surrounded people and how they went to church the very next day or the next Sunday. You know, I honestly have never heard this kind of conversation in church. I've never heard someone, you know, before you and the conversation we had with Katie Faust on the theology of getting fired is, you know, where is this message in church? Like, where are the pastors? Can you briefly speak to the pastors and elders and leaders and talk about like, how can they support their congregation in developing a more robust theology of workplace behavior on what they're, you know, okay with? And hey, this is my line in the sand and this is my theology of getting fired. How do pastors and leaders talk to their congregants about this? Mm-hmm. And what is their role when their congregants start to experience some of this? I don't think that, you know, the two people that you mentioned are the mom, you know, who might have a gag order on talking about Christianity. I think right now, today, she's an outlier. Mm-hmm. But in a year or maybe two, I think in Christian circles, she may not be. Can mm-hmm. you speak to pastors and leaders a little bit about that?
Yeah. And I do want to say, I mean, I've kind of told the bad stories and I have heard really great stories. For example, Lori Smith, who was the founder of 303 Creative, enormous Supreme Court win. You know, she talks about how great her church has been. Tanner Cross was the elementary coach who got fired from his school in Loudoun County, Virginia. He, you know, member of the Loudoun County School Board, you know, saga, you know, there during COVID, and his church was absolutely fantastic. There are those that do it, and I think so. What does it look like? I think one is you do tell the story. You do tell the story of these people. You do highlight it. You do describe it. You do correct the misinformation, because the misinformation, you know, is that's what the media is telling when these things take off, right? So that's a key thing. I think it's going to be really hard for pastors who aren't already talking about Christianity's cultural implications. And, you know, a buddy of mine there is in Southern California, and he told me that, you know, in the months, you know, right there, actually near Santa Ana and all over there. And he told me, you know, in the months following the helicopter crash in which Kobe Bryant died, never came up in church for like 5 or 6 weeks. And you're like, the whole world was talking about that. And even, it had been weird for my pastor maybe to bring it up because, you know, I'm in Colorado, but, you know, here are folks that played, you know, Little League soccer with Gigi. And so I think, but when you do that systemically, like you never talk about it, it's more than just the fact that you know, you're not getting a Christian take on this issue. It's even more than the fact that instead of a Christian take, you're getting a secular take on this issue. I think kind of the third consequence of never talking about those things is that it gives people the impression that the Bible doesn't actually speak to those kinds of things. And so then you're actually framing and discipling and catechizing a congregation wrongly about what kind of book the Bible is and what kind of life the Christian is and what kind of Lord Jesus is, you know? And so that to me is the ability to connect the challenges of the moment with the eternal story and seeing our cultural moment as a moment within redemptive history. That is half the battle here. Because then it makes it a lot easier to say, you know, here's an example. I think that what our brothers and sisters are facing around the world is a great way to talk about that. By the way, I do also want to acknowledge something that's really important. And I struggle with this personally, just, you know, having been connected with a church whose leadership was in Nigeria for a long time in particular. And that's been a top level of concern for us at the Colson Center, because it is for me. We've done work with International Congress on Nigeria and the work they're trying to do in keeping it front and center on the attention of the United States government to really protect Christians there. Is that I struggle, and a lot of, I think, people do when they hear about these horrific ways that Christians around the world are often treated. And I don't know if you knew this, but you know, the worst year on record for Christian persecution was 2023. Prior to that, it was 2022. Prior to that, it was 2021. I mean, at least according to Open Doors and some of these other groups, when you think about North Korea, Myanmar, basically the authoritarian communist states and the authoritarian Islamic states, there is a direct targeting of Christians. And that's because, of course, Christians recognize that there's a higher authority than the state. And that's that you can't live that way if you're trying to run an authoritarian state. So I think people struggle and pastors struggle to call what's happening to us persecution in the United States, especially when compared to that. I struggle with that, too. I appreciate a little bit of some of the differences drawn between hard persecution and soft persecution. Like, you know, look, if I get fired from my job, that's not the same as someone watching their children, you know, butchered in front of their eyes or something like that. On the other hand, man, Jack Phillips, he has been targeted. His well-being has been targeted. He has endured death threats. His family has undergone incredible pressure. And we're over a decade now, literally for over 10 years. I mean, that you got to call that something. And I think the ability to recognize where that stuff's really happening, and it's more than just kind of the hypothetical of, are you going to be made fun of? And what would you do? You know, that my Sunday school teacher sometimes would bring up. It's, you know, these are real situations. You know, for this Indiana mom and dad, you know, their son was taken out of their home by Child Protective Services. I'm a parent of, you know, four kids. I can't imagine, other than, you know, torturing my wife in front of me. How do you live with, I mean, that what do you do when you got nothing to do? Your power, I mean, that to me, you got to call it something, I guess. And I think being willing, you know, to tell the stories as they actually are is something that we can do.
I think that a lot of people, you know, they stumble sometimes, I think, in our American affluence of, you know, how could I ever think about getting fired or leaving my job? Because I've become accustomed to a certain lifestyle here in you know, it's a money issue. And I think if we're going to think about things worldviewishly, part of that conversation has to also include trusting the Lord, obedience to the Lord's instructions, and that he will care for us. And that, I think, is something we haven't had to wrestle with too much as Americans. But when we're thinking about, okay, let's call it, for the sake of discussion, soft persecution, or things that we have to, we decide we want to be at stake for. I mean, in the example of the cake baker, that has had monetary consequences for that guy and that brother in the Lord. And so we can't necessarily make a principled decision of, well, this just seems too complicated. I don't want to make this stand because it's going to impact my lifestyle. At some point, as individuals and as churches and church leaders, we might have to think about monetary consequences and even how to come around each other and helping each other through those transitionary times.
No question. I won't name names, but I know someone who went through that sort of a long extended thing and, you know, lost all their retirement, had to make that decision. And look, I know it's kind of recent in world history that people had a retirement, you know, that weren't their own children. But, you know, that was a real loss. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars for this person. And when you understand that, and I was really grateful. And I don't feel like I should name names here, but there were major Christian organizations and leaders that came around and figured out how to solve that problem for her. And I think that that is something that we need to be thinking about. You know, those of us that aren't facing those decisions, kind of reading the times. You know, this is going to sound like a strange connection, so hang with me here, Krista, but I think your point is so absolutely important. I've been, you know, looking at, there's a couple of folks who've been writing about how humans deal with computers and internet life and then predicting what does that look like when it comes to robots and artificial intelligence. One of this is a person named Sherry Turkle, and Turkle has written books on technology and so on. And she says, you know, based on how humans behave today, she's a social scientist looking at human behavior. This is what I predict it's going to look like, you know, when technology evolves to, you know, the next level. And she's been right, by the way, 3 out of 3 times. And I think about, you know, your scenario and say, should we be hopeful based on the current state of how the church deals with financial incentives when it comes to these harder decisions? And when you think, for example, of the calculation that comes in and on the basis that people, you know, make kind of the tough decisions, like I'm thinking about, you know, when church folk choose abortions or something along those lines, are we making, you know, good decisions or, you know, the number, how we even treat having children as, you know, young married Protestants who don't have a Catholic ethic on this, you know, oh, I don't have enough money to have kids. You know, you just see how all the other decisions are being made when it comes to money. And I, you're right. I'm not sure that we have we have the right framework for making these decisions, and that we are making them based on a criteria different than the one that Jesus gave. And, you know, Monique, to your earlier question about, you know, where's the Bible? What's the Bible say about this? The Bible gives you a very, very, very specific framework, which is love God and love your neighbor as yourself. And there, in any real sense of the word love, any real understanding of God and who my neighbor is, that's the sort of consequence. You know, this Wisconsin's mom's neighbor was her daughter in this situation, and she had to make the decision primarily based out of that motivation. To love God is to love what God loves. To love God is to love truth. To love God is to love his people. To love God is to love the people who are victimized by bad ideas. So that's going to have to be the framework. That's going to have to be the deciding factor. And yeah, I do think the comfortability, is that a word I'm trying to say here, that we have as Americans is going to have to be rethought kind of top to bottom here. And I'm not trying to be a doom and gloom thing. I'm not trying to kind of paint a picture that's not realistic. I'm just meeting these people that are having to make these decisions. And they just amaze me. And then the question is, how do I love them well? And that, you know, that's got to motivate it as well. So anyway, I think that is a very important insight, Krista, in terms about how are we going to make this decision? Are we going to be prepared to make it if the situation arises?
Yeah, I'm a big believer in, you know, looking at the Proverbs for wisdom. And there's a lot of things to be said there about saving and money management and choosing your friends. And I just see a lot of principles that are all connected to this conversation from a worldview standpoint. Well, thank you, John, for joining us. I hope people will follow your good work there at the Colson Center and your podcast, Breakpoint, with getting so much of your perspectives and keeping your pulse on what's happening in culture and getting that information through a Christian worldview. So thank you so much for joining us and talking about these issues.
Listen, thank you. I'm a big fan of your guys' work as well, as you know. And so it's an honor to be on with you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks. Tell the family we said hi. What a fun and helpful conversation. I love that John knows so much of church history and, you know, can actually bring us all the way back to the beginning and then walk us through where we find ourselves today.
It's a little bit like talking to the encyclopedia. He was going to get us up to speed on all the history and even across the globe and making all the connections. But that's great. And that's what having a worldview means, is that it's a really big thing.
It is. And all of that history, you know, whether it's Christian or secular, when we filter it through the lens of scripture, helps us to develop the full orbed worldview, as you're saying, and will help us understand how we should be walking out our faith today. And so I'm so glad that that he brought all of that history and knowledge to our current, you know, cultural conversation.
Yeah, I feel like maybe there's another podcast lurking in the background of a theology of when to fire. That could be a whole other conversation, you know?
Yeah, you know,
you kind of alluded to it a couple of times, but we didn't go into it. But to me, that's sort of the other side of the coin.
I think the podcast could also be called How to Remain Faithful and Obedient.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's really what we're talking about. Yeah. Whether you are firing or whether you are getting fired, it all lines up with how do we remain faithful and obedient to God? How do we keep our gaze, focus, allegiance toward the cross? And that's what it comes down to, because as I'm walking committed in heart, mind, and spirit to the Lord, I won't be distracted or allow myself to be pulled off course from that. And so staying on that course will necessarily mean that some things are going to fall away, because some things are going to try to pull you into disobedience.
That's so good. That's such a good place to land the show. We do want to remind people that we will be live next week, so people can tune in, and we'll both be back here in studio and have a live show. So you won't want to miss it. We're not announcing the topic just yet. It's going to be a little bit of a surprise, but you will definitely want to tune in for the live show. We want to encourage you again, as always, to download the Center for Biblical Unity app on your mobile device. That's the best way to stay connected with the ministry, get all our latest content. Also, make sure that you have signed up for our weekly digital newsletter. And with that, have a good week and God bless.
God bless.
Thanks for listening to All the Things. Be sure to subscribe to our website at allthethingsshow.com and find us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or wherever you stream your podcast. Be sure to hit that subscribe button and the bell so you'll receive alerts when we post new shows. We'll see you next week.